Yes, sir. I'll reserve 5 minutes.
5 minutes, yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. This is Aaron Campbell from the Attorney General's Office, representing the Commonwealth. This is a Commonwealth's appeal in which the Commonwealth below argued three reasons why the firearm should not have been suppressed. And I will take them in reverse order from how I laid them out in my brief. The first one I'll begin with is that the Commonwealth argued that the firearm should not have been suppressed. The doctrine of inevitable discovery should have been applied and that the exclusionary rule should not have, be applied in this case. The reason for that is probably best laid out by the facts and sort of the sequence of events. This was a situation where the passenger of the vehicle, the defendant, he was placed into custody because the police had found an outstanding warrant and they were in the process of confirming that. While that was going on, they saw a gun in the center console of the vehicle. It's a little unclear whether or not at that point the officers removed it or when exactly they removed it, but it is clear that they ran a background check after they discovered the firearm, and during that background check they discovered that the defendant had a was a felon. It is the Commonwealth's position that the police would ultimately have found out his felon status and therefore had probable cause to actually seize the gun based on his felon status, because he was in the process of being arrested. There are Virginia statutes that talk about an arrestee has to, there has to be a criminal background check performed whenever there is an arrestee and he is brought before a magistrate.
Judge Humphreys, can I ask you about that?
Yeah, sure.
It seems to me that your inevitable discovery argument depends upon the notion, well, first of all, what we have here is the gun was found prior to, as I understand the timeline, prior to him being arrested. Initially, they knew he was wanted, but not what for. It turned out later to be failure to appear, and then later on they found out he was also a convicted felon. But at the time the gun was seized, they didn't know any of that. But as I understand your inevitable discovery argument, that would have to, it seems to me, to be based upon the fact that they not only they necessarily would have run a record check, which the record doesn't necessarily support, but assuming that is the case, that they would have done that, wouldn't they also have done a search of the vehicle to seize the weapon? Because typically a search incident to an arrest would not include the vehicle if the defendant is well away from the vehicle. And here I think he was at the back the trunk area, handcuffed. So I'm not sure. I mean, I guess you're arguing a search incident to an arrest based on their later discovery that he was a felon, but we don't know when that would have taken place or where the vehicle would have been, do we?
I think I might have lost track of your question, but
I guess what I'm getting at is simply this: the inevitable discovery doctrine. What's required for that is, as the name implies, that the record is such that it's clear that the otherwise improperly seized, in this case, gun would have inevitably been found based upon proper police conduct. And it seems to me, in order for the Commonwealth to get there from here, we not only would have to presume that they would have at some point run a record check, but also then at some point searched the vehicle and seized the gun.
Yeah, well, my response to that is that they had seen the gun already, so they didn't need to exactly search the vehicle.
Except that you're stuck with the fact finder's conclusion that the gun was not in plain view, so it would have been an illegal seizure search. Well, maybe not a search if they had no standing, but certainly an illegal seizure at that point if in fact it was not in plain view. Of course, if it was in plain view, we're done. We don't have to worry about any of this stuff, do we?
If it was in plain view, yes, and that we knew that his felon status.
This is Judge Annunziata. I wanted to
continue
with the discussion on the inevitable discovery. And I just point you to the page 9 of opposing counsel's brief. Makes the argument that Kamo's reliance on 19276 and 19280.2 is misplaced because there was no evidence at the suppression hearing that the officer who might have run the warrant search, that he was either familiar with the statutes or that he always complied with it or that he in fact complied with it. So I guess there are three possible opportunities that might be of an evidentiary nature that would be important for your argument, would it not? Or do we just assume that because this, here's the second part of that, I shouldn't ask a compound question, or is the reverse that one should assume that because these statutes in place that search for any outstanding warrants would have been made at some point at the right time?
And that the second part, that's our argument.
We don't have
the officer saying that I recognize these statutes, and like in some of these other cases, we don't have them saying that, well, we were going to run a criminal background check anyway, but I think the fact that they did run a criminal background check, I think we would just have to argue that we would assume that they would have followed suit and
Ran the check, though, but it was after the most pertinent evidence, I guess, that you would need to be in your favor, would it not?
Right.
You're saying that this point really kind of troubled me a bit. I assume that they ran the criminal background check at the appropriate time? And I mean assume, literally. Is that what you're saying?
I guess I would have to rely on in the normal course of business police would do that. Which may not be enough, I understand.
The reason I'm still sounding hesitant is because there is a timing issue in this case, is there not?
Yeah, I mean, what they did, it would be no problem if they had ran the background check, found out his felon status, and removed the gun.
Yeah, understood.
They took it out of order. They apparently, though the record is not entirely clear, seized the gun before the background check was done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's just this one step that's out of order. And does the doctrine of inevitable discovery apply in this situation?
Mm-hmm.
And that's...
To follow up on Anunziata's question, I guess your argument comes down to inevitability equals the presumption, some sort of a presumption of regularity. Is that essentially it?
Yeah, and the fact that we have these statutes that require...
It's been a long time since I've been a prosecutor, but I wish I had a nickel for every time a police officer didn't follow a statute.
Before I run out of too much time on this, mm-hmm. I'll move on to my other arguments. The second argument is that the officers had probable cause that there was a concealed firearm, and this is what the officer believed that there was, that this firearm was concealed, and therefore he had probable cause to seize it. The trial court's letter opinion is a little bit muddled because they seem to equate probable cause with whether or not the weapon was concealed and whether or not it was in plain view doctrine.
You really can't have it both ways, Mr. Campbell, it seems to me. It's either if it's concealed, then it's not in plain view, but if it's in plain view, then it's not concealed. So which way is the Commonwealth relying on here?
We're arguing that it was concealed, or at least there was probable cause that it was concealed. Ultimately, they may not win the argument if it goes back down that it was concealed, but our argument...
If it's concealed and then seized without a warrant and without any exception applying, then how is that not a Fourth Amendment violation?
Well, the argument is that it was a concealed firearm, in violation of the concealed firearm statute, that they had probable cause to seize
the probable cause didn't arise until after it was improperly seized, correct?
No, I think the probable cause arose when they were able to partially see it, and that based on their observation that firearm was in violation of the concealed firearm statute.
Didn't the fact finder implicitly reject that they could see it? I mean, it seems to be the letter opinion from the circuit court made it pretty clear that she wasn't buying the notion that it was in plain view, but for the standing argument, it would have been an improper search as well as an improper seizure.
I wasn't sure that Mr. Campbell, just so you're
okay. I wasn't sure that page 92 says it doesn't appear that the gun was not in plain view, but I'm not sure that the fact finder was saying that it was completely unable to be seen at all by the officers. I think the officers were, at least my reading of the record is, they were at least able to see it partially, and that's why they thought it was in violation of the concealed firearm statute. And if I could, I would like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Right, very well. Mr. Reyes?
Thank you. May it please the Court, Christopher Reyes for Mr. Simpson in this case. I do believe that the circuit court was correct in granting the suppression motion, and initially this gun was not in plain view. That is a clear finding that was made by the circuit court. So the only way that these officers got this gun was through a search and illegal seizure of the gun.
Mr. Reyes, if I may ask you a question. This is Judge Huff. Do you agree that the sole basis for the ruling of the court turned out to be that the defendant had asserted the sole basis for saying that the defendant had standing, rather, was that the defendant asserted a possessory interest in the gun?
From the letter opinion, I would have to agree with you, Judge Huff, that the circuit court did seem to find standing based solely on his claiming of the gun itself, a possessory interest in the gun.
And isn't that exactly contrary to the United States versus Savucci case, where the Supreme Court decided that was no longer the appropriate standard?
Yes, absolutely. I do agree with you. The correct standard is that he had a possessory interest in the item seized, but also an expectation of privacy in the area of the car that was searched. But the court did not make any sort of finding as far as an expectation of privacy or any factual findings about that as well.
But, sir, you did make that argument. May I confirm that? That he had an expectation of privacy? You made that argument before the court.
I believe I did make that argument, but the court
this one
did not address it.
Understood. Thank you.
So what would be the expectation of privacy if he's not an owner or lessee or whatever of the vehicle, renter? You know, what expectation of privacy would you have in someone else's car, I guess would be the question.
I believe that as a passenger in the car, and where the gun was located and the care taken in hiding the gun shows that he had some sort of expectation of privacy in that area of the car. It is easily reachable by the passenger side, and it is a place that a passenger would be expected to put their personal possessions. It is behind the gear shift and underneath kind of the dash in this little cubbyhole, and then it was covered up with stuff in addition to being hidden behind a big gulp cup. So I do believe that there is a subjective and objective expectation.
Well, it seems to me the record is not clear to establish that. Granting your point, it would seem to me that the record would have to establish that your client was the one who put it there and took steps to hide it. There's nothing in the record. Well, I mean, I guess there's an inference that he put it there, but it's not a secret compartment. It's as I understand it, it's part of the console, and there was, I think, a Burger King cup or something that was in the way that that at least partially obstructed the officer's view of it, but that doesn't necessarily equate to a deliberate attempt by whoever put it there, including your client, to hide it from common observation, does it?
I think it does, and there...
That proposition.
I guess the record is unclear and doesn't really state that he took any deliberate steps to put it there. But the court obviously didn't make any sort of ruling on that issue.
Well, how do we get past the Rakus standard? As I read Rakus, the court was doing away with the standard from the 1960 Jones case, saying that being legitimately on the premises or legitimately in the vehicle in this case would give rise to standing. But that was done away with in Rakus, and isn't that all we have for your client? He was legitimately in the car, but he had no possessory interest. He would not be in a position to exclude others who may want to come into the automobile. He had no ownership interest. He was strictly a guest. So how do we get a reasonable expectation of privacy out of that? Something beyond the Jones standard.
Well, I think what it comes down to is where this gun was actually located and how it was hidden. And unfortunately, the record doesn't contain any facts showing that he put it there and that he took steps to hide it. But at this point in time, since the motion was granted, we have to the court must grant all reasonable inferences from the evidence, and I think it's a reasonable inference that he's the person that put it there and he took steps to hide it, which would give him an expectation of privacy in that area of the car. And so I think based on that, he does have standing. And so that brings us back to whether the officers had any sort of probable cause to essentially search and seize illegally this gun. And I think it's clear from the record that the court found this gun was not in plain sight. So there is no probable cause that the officer could have had as far as that this was a gun.
Let me interrupt you again. Analytically, would it make any difference if we concluded that your client had no standing to object to the search but did have standing to object to the seizure? What analytical difference do you think that might make?
So, I understand the difficulty in doing that. And I didn't focus on the search at my argument in the lower court, but I think they kind of come together at this point in time. I think if he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in that area and in the gun itself, then that would give him standing to challenge both the search and the seizure of the gun, and I don't think that there would be any sort of analytical difference between the two.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. And as I was saying, I don't believe that there was any evidence in the record showing that the officers had probable cause to believe that there was a concealed weapon or a concealed gun in the car. As far as the Commonwealth's argument about inevitable discovery, again, the record lacks any evidence that the officers would have ran his record and determined that he was a felon without having previously seized the gun from the vehicle. I think the record is clear that he was taken out of the car and arrested, and that the gun was taken out of the car prior to him telling them that he was a felon, and that they ran his record after he said he was a felon. So I don't think inevitable discovery would apply because there is no evidence showing that the officers would have taken the necessary steps, and just because there are statutes, again, we have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Simpson in this case, and there is no evidence that they would have done that, and I don't think the Commonwealth can simply rely on the statutes. So I would ask that this court uphold the circuit court's finding that there was a Fourth Amendment violation here.
I have one more question on the standing, if I might. If we were to conclude the evidence supported, well, that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the place searched, but had no legitimate possessory interest, can you still make your claim of standing?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the issue with that is no one has a legitimate possessory interest in anything that's contraband. If we're talking about illegal narcotics or even a felon with a gun. Those things are suppressed by courts all the time. And it doesn't.
Well, the reason I ask the question is because on your brief, page 4 to 5, you seem to make that contention in a sense, and you cite right after it to U.S. v. Salvucci. I don't think that's what that case says. So clearly you're not making that argument. If you don't have a possessory interest, but you have a reasonable expectation of privacy that meets the qualifications of what is reasonable, you could still make a case for standing, right?
Yes, I do agree with you on that.
Yeah, on the ground, just as you say. I mean, if you have illegal drugs on the thesis that you would need both, you would never get to a standing position.
Absolutely, exactly, yes.
I got it now. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Reyes?
No, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Campbell, you have 4 minutes remaining.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. A couple points about standing. First of all, the defendant has the burden to establish standing. And below, the defendant argued on page 60 and on page 72 that the reason he had standing was because he had a property interest in the item that was seized, which is, as the court's already pointed out, is not the standard. It has to be a possessory interest in the area that is searched. And our argument, both now and below, was that he didn't have a possessory interest in the place searched. It's not his vehicle. Many courts across the Commonwealth, across the country, have just said that passengers do not have a expectation of privacy for items that are searched. And many of those cases are cited in this court's opinion in Joseph v. Commonwealth, which is a decision from 1990, 10 Virginia App 87. And we would simply say that the defendant has not met its burden in this situation. He has not put forth the evidence that is needed to establish that he had a legitimate expectation of privacy in that center console area of the vehicle. This is not like the Army.
Isn't it your burden to establish that he didn't? I mean, this is a warrantless search. Therefore, it's the government or the Commonwealth's burden to establish that no warrant was required and that it fits one of the exceptions. So whether it's plain view or lack of standing or inevitable discovery, I mean, the burden is entirely on the Commonwealth, not on the defendant to establish anything.
It was my understanding, based on Rakes, is that the defendant has a burden to establish that he has a legitimate expectation.
He has to demonstrate that he has either an interest in the place searched or the thing seized, but that's all. Once he does that, then the burden of establishing the legality of the search shifts. Clearly, if he doesn't have standing, we don't care how illegal it was. It could be in violation in the abstract of any Fourth Amendment concept you want to come up with, but if you've got no standing to object to it, it doesn't really matter.
Yes, I think that's my point. I'm not sure that maybe I'm not making myself clear, is that our argument is that he doesn't have a legitimate expectation of privacy in the area that's searched, and that's the Rakes standard.
What about the Jones case, not the earlier Jones case that where you had automatic standing that was overruled in Rakes, but the more recent United States versus Jones, where Justice Scalia, I think it was a 2012 case, the GPS locator case, where Justice Scalia, writing for the 5-4 majority of the court, held that they sort of resurrected the old property interest standard, the pre-Katz standard, and now I guess we have a dual standard, not only an expectation of privacy, but if you have a property interest in either the place searched or the thing seized, you would have standing.
I didn't read that case in preparation for this, so I'd have to look at it again. I mean, I'm familiar with the case. But I honestly, I just don't have your answer because I just don't recall the in what context.
Well, there was a trespass, you know, sort of a common law. I think Justice Scalia, as he traditionally did, applied common law principles to these things, and that was the case where they put the GPS on the car, on the vehicle, the argument was that there's no expectation of privacy on the vehicles traveling around on the public highways, and Justice Scalia pointed out, yes, but you trespassed on the personal property when they actually put the GPS locator device on the vehicle, and suggested that the possessory interest factor, or I guess it was Olmstead versus the United States that was overruled in Katz, is sort of back in play, at least to some extent.
I mean, at least in some extent, but I guess my answer, at least in this case, is that it wasn't his vehicle. It may have been his.
It's his gun. I mean, doesn't he have hasn't he asserted a property or a possessory interest in the weapon? So, assuming he had no standing for the search, wouldn't that give him standing to object to the seizure?
If you can wrap it up with this, please, Mr. Campbell, your time is close to expired.
Okay. I don't know, Your Honor, but I would just rely on what I've argued so far.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. The case is submitted. You will hear from us shortly. We'll stand in recess, and the court will now go into conference. Thank you all.
All right, thank you
very much.
Bye-bye.